I really hope when people read this, they will understand how important it is, but also how special it is, how it really reflects who we are, and how there's some deliberation in the symbolism in that building. Again, building it out of materials that will last.
That's Brian J. Jones, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Ahead, we'll talk about The Capitol, a surprising biography of an American building. Brian J. Jones is a critically acclaimed best-selling biographer of some of the world's most iconic creative geniuses. His previous books include Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and The Making of an American Imagination, Jim Henson, The Biography, and George Lucas, A Life. Brian, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've written critically acclaimed biographies of people, but this is different. So what made you want to approach the history of the Capitol as a biography?
So I've always done sort of large, iconic American figures, and this is sort of the largest, most iconic one I think I've done in a literal sense. It was one of those things that I was a congressional staffer for almost a decade. I lived and worked right on Capitol Hill, lived and worked inside that building. After January 6th, it was actually one of those things I wanted to do right by the building after that. And I had proposed to my agent doing this. I said, I would love to do something with the Capitol, but I'm a biographer. That strikes me as history. And he said, just treat it as a biography. The Capitol is your main character. And how do people interact with the Capitol? And what do people say about it? And what are the stories people tell about it? You're essentially doing the same research and the same work you do as a biographer of a person. So that's why I actually love that it's called the surprising biography of an American building, because it really is a biography. It's a lot of people in it, but the Capitol is front and center the entire time. The Capitol is the main character in the book. So it's approached very much as a biography, and I hope people will read it in that way. This is not going to be sort of a hit, you know, I don't want to call history dry, but it's not a straight up history. It's all about people and personalities and ideals. And that's kind of what the Capitol's always been about since its very inception.
There's so much in this book that we're not going to have time to talk about. And you've touched on a little bit, but give us a brief overview of what readers are going to find here.
Well, I think they're going to find that the Capitol building itself, sort of like the American experiment, is one that is based in improvisation and optimism and violence and idealism and compromise. And it's as flexible and fungible and as at risk at times as the American experiment itself, as democracy itself, as the nation itself. It has gone up and down with the nation. Anytime we have sort of been at a crossroads, something has happened within that building that has expressed that. It's very much an expression of the American psyche, deliberately, intentionally or not. That was what was so interesting about it. It always did sort of seem to reflect what was going on in the nation. Sometimes deliberately, people were in the building doing things. Sometimes it just happened to be the actual physical condition the Capitol was in during the Civil War. It is unfinished, like the nation itself. The dome is not yet done. On through the 20th century, as we're trying to make our way into the world, the building is in a state of gradual progress and improvement and adding things onto it and modernizing it, sort of like the country was as well. So it's one of those buildings that really reflects, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not, where we are and who we are.
You spent a lot of time in this building, as you mentioned, but was there a point in your research you thought, wow, there's a lot of weird and strange stuff here that I didn't know and certainly the general public doesn't know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's so interesting. One of the things that was so interesting to me, and I don't know what, if I did know this at one point, I had forgotten it. I had forgotten that the dome itself, when you stand there and look up at it, it appears to be marble or stone, and it is entirely made out of cast iron. I had forgotten that. Partly it was because it was a much lighter material to use at the time, so it didn't weigh down on the building. It was a real marvel of engineering. Partly is because those columns you see at the time were used for drainage and were often used for chimneys, so it was very practical use to it. But the other thing that was so fascinating to me and is that when you're looking at the dome, there's a little bit of sleight of hand going on there, and that is not actually resting on the roof of the Capitol. The rotunda, the round part of the center of the Capitol, is extended up, and then there's struts extending out from the walls of the rotunda that are actually holding the dome, the weight of the dome on those struts. It's not resting down on top of the building. The weight's not being carried by the roof. They did a little bit more of sleight of hand by taking an iron, some white iron and wrapping that around the base of it and making it look like it's sitting on this platform, but it's actually not. The rotunda is doing all the work in there. It's a really interesting sort of architectural sleight of hand. I don't know that I ever actually knew that, or if I did, I did not appreciate it. It's really interesting what's going on up there.
Now, of course, we have a lot of history in this building, presidents that people know about, but there are people you profile in the book that people probably don't know about. Tell us about some of those colorful characters.
So what was really fun about writing this book is every chapter seems to have two people who are going at it. And it's usually an architect and the superintendent that's in charge with working the architect's will. Because usually what happens is you have an ambitious and smart and talented superintendent that thinks they know better than the architect does. And one of my favorite parts of the book is when you're getting into the 1850s and they were trying to expand the Capitol to add extensions on the ends, the extensions that are there now where the House and the Senate are. Then they brought in Thomas Walter, a really talented architect, and as his superintendent, they assigned Montgomery Meigs, who is from the Army Corps of Engineering, a brilliant engineer, but somebody whose ego and Bruce feelings are in the way constantly. He's always trying to get his fingerprints on the building. He is literally having his name molded into some of the ironwork that's holding up one of the ceilings, to the point where Walter kind of laughs and says he'll be signing Vulcan's fire here eventually. But the two of them, they ended up working really well together, even though there was a lot of friction. But that's one of my favorite relationships because it's a wonder things got done under those two. But they were both really, really brilliant. I mean, Meigs was a fantastic engineer. He's the one who figured out how to get the cranes in the poking out of the top of the dome to carry the materials to the top. And Walter is the one who, as he was designing the building, and this is a fantastic story, he had put the extensions on the edge of the building, and the dome that was there, Walter said, I'm not sure that that's really big enough for the size of this building now. And nobody had asked him to do this. He just drew this really detailed, wonderful picture of the Capitol with a brand new dome on it, looking very much like the final dome looks like, and just hung it in his office. And congressmen would walk by and they'd sort of be shuffling by his office and they would turn and look and they'd say, can we have that? And Meigs, who kind of wanted credit for that dome, said, absolutely, we can give you that. But it was a dome nobody asked for. Nobody had asked him to do this. He just thought it would look better. It was another one of those really wonderful instances of like ad-libbing and improvising, getting into the building and becoming an iconic part of that building. But the chapters with those two going at it is really, really fascinating. And one of the other really interesting things about Montgomery Meigs is he was sort of handpicked by the chairman of the Public Works Committee, who at that time was Jefferson Davis. And Jefferson Davis is weirdly really important to the Capitol story, because when he was in the Congress as a senator, he was one of those people that insisted the Capitol needs to be built out of materials that will last. He really understood the symbolism of building the Capitol out of durable materials. The nation needs to be durable. The nation needs to stand. The materials in the Capitol should reflect that. The irony is that years later, he would be leading the assault against everything that building stood for, but was really, really important when he was in the Congress in getting the building done. And again, he had appointed Meigs. Now, Meigs at one point can't read the room. And when his own position is in trouble, he sort of starts throwing Jefferson Davis's name around. And nobody wants to hear that at that time. But the relationship between Meigs and Walter is really fascinating, really fun, kind of funny. And it is one of those things where you're just in awe that they actually got as much done as they did. They're the ones that essentially made that building look the way it does today. I mean, that building you see today is essentially the way Montgomery Meigs and Thomas Walter left it.
As you mentioned, there is the idea, and they were talking about, needed to have a certain permanence to it, had to be built out of materials that would stand the test of time. But yet it also needs to evolve and change. And you say that's symbolic of our nation as a whole.
Yeah. It was when they first built the Capitol, the first version of it was built out of wood. And the dome itself was made out of wood and just painted copper color. It was the materials they sort of had on hand. That made it very easy for the building to rot. It made it very easy for the building to be burnt, as we saw in 1814. So every time they would go back and fix it, they would try to make it better. Sort of like us with the American experiment. Every time something would happen, we would try to fix it. We would try to make things a little bit better. As new states came in, we would try to figure out what was the term and condition under which they entered. So back in the early 1800s, when they, after the capital was burnt by the British, they started building the foundations out of stone and out of stone arches instead of wood timbers. The Library of Congress, which was housed in the capital for a long time, was a real problem because not only did you have books in the capital, which were very flammable, but the building itself was very flammable at that point. Eventually, it built the Library of Congress out of cast iron, mainly to keep it from burning, but that partly inspired the way that one of the decisions to use cast iron in building the dome. They'd had so much success with it in the Library of Congress and thought it was so beautiful. At one point, somebody visited the Library of Congress in the Capitol and declared that it was the most beautiful room in the world. That room does not exist anymore anywhere in the Capitol, but you see these etchings of it, and it's a fantastic room. But they realized those materials were light, they were fireproof, and that really informed them building the dome out of it, light and fireproof. The dome itself that was originally wooden and painted copper color, there were constant fears, even when, you know, if there was a fire in the building, that that dome was going to catch fire. So there was a constant worry about the quality of the materials. Anytime they were upgrading, they would try to make it marble material instead of, and there's sandstone, but then they tried to go to marble and better quality stone. So constantly trying to improve and update that building every time they went back and laid hands on it.
Tell us about the role of enslaved people in the history of this building and other monuments that we see in D.C.
Yeah, you know, enslaved people played a huge role in the construction and building of the Capitol. And in particular, there's a great story of an enslaved craftsman who is responsible for a lot of the work that was done, ironically, on the Statue of Freedom on top of the Capitol. When the building was first going up in the late 1700s, early 1800s, most of the work was being done by enslaved artisans and craftsmen and children who could, you know, a lot of the work involved building bricks out of just mud and baking the bricks. And so a lot of that sort of work was done by enslaved people. The most compelling story, I thought, was it's a craftsman named Philip Reed, who worked at the Mills Foundry just outside of Washington, D.C. He was an enslaved craftsman, incredibly talented. He had partly been responsible for molding the statue of Andrew Jackson, the one that in New Orleans, in fact, is the similar to that statue of Jackson. And when they brought the first draft of the Statue of Freedom over from Europe, it was in 5 pieces and had to be assembled so you could see what it would look like. And it was 19 feet high, so gigantic statue, beautiful statue. An American craftsman had screwed all the pieces together, so it was in one big 19-foot piece. And they looked at it, they said, okay, that looks great. You know, this is what it's going to look like done. Now we have to cast it, but you have to cast it in all 5 pieces. So they had to take it apart again and take it for casting. The guy who had put it together said, okay, well, if you want me to take it apart, it's going to cost you more money. They didn't have the money to pay for that, and nobody could figure out how to take it apart. Well, Philip Reed is the one who said, she's got a hook up in her helmet. If you would just hang her from that hook, her own weight would start to pull it apart. You would at least be able to see the cracks in the statue so you could take her apart at those points. So he figured out just that sort of math problem right there. But then once they moved those 5 pieces up to Maryland, he was the one they put in charge of casting her and, you know, overseeing her reconstruction, putting her together. You know, and he started off that project enslaved and was freed by Abraham Lincoln. And by the time the statue went on top of the Capitol, he was free. Now, we don't know if he was actually there in D.C. watching the day that it was attached to the top of the Capitol. But I there's something touching and compelling that this incredibly talented enslaved artist is the one responsible. He did not carve it. That was done by another artist. But he was the one who was responsible for getting that statue completed and getting the Statue of Freedom on top of the Capitol. He's the one who figured out all the tough things it took to get that statue assembled and cast it himself. And, you know, there's a lot of talent in that statue. And a lot of that talent is an enslaved American.
In addition to some of these moving and fascinating stories about people associated with the Capitol building, you also just have some bizarre items in there, including something about some ghostly cat paw prints. What's that all about?
So it's so funny. When I was talking with some of my friends who I had worked in the Senate with, that I was writing this book, one of my friends said immediately, you have to talk about the cat prints. That's one of those stories that as a Hill staffer, we all know about. At one point, a bomb had gone off in the Senate reception room and had damaged a lot of one portion of the Capitol. It didn't kill anybody. It didn't actually do a whole lot of damage, but it had collapsed some of the stonework. And in one of the hallways, they had to repave the floor and they'd pour new concrete on the floor. And as that concrete was setting, a cat walked through and left their footprints in it. Now, where the mythology starts to come into place, there are a number of accounts of security guards and policemen who had reported seeing gigantic cats, devil cats, running through the halls of the Capitol. Even in the newspaper reports at the time, they're trying very hard to contain their laughter and not come out and say directly they believed the person was intoxicated. But there were a number of stories that came out right at the time. There's also the words DC are etched in the stone at one point in the floors. And some people said that stood for Devil's Cat, and it is most likely just stood for Washington, DC. But that's one of those really funny stories that most Hill staffers know. A lot of people know the mythology behind it. You can still see those tracks if you're looking for them in the floor. The other story that people loved, and a lot of my friends and former colleagues also wanted to be sure was in there, is what we call the fairy doors. And there's doors along some of the corridors in the Capitol about, 2 feet high. And they look like they belong in the Shire from Lord of the Rings. They're just these little tiny doors, and they're, very elaborately, carved. So they look up, they have doorknobs. And people always wonder what's behind them, whether, do cats live here? Are there leprechauns here? And actually, those were just put in. If you pull those open, there's just a spigot about high enough to get a bucket under so you can fill a bucket up with water so you could mop the tiles on the floor. And it was also so they could get water into the building if the building caught fire. This was after the lessons they had learned when the Library of Congress caught fire. So they had brought water into the Capitol. It was actually Montgomery Meigs who did this, brought water into the Capitol that way, and those doors make it more accessible to get to the water. But that's one of those things that's still there today in the Capitol that people walk through and just wonder what these little doors are down along the floor line.
Well, as I said, there's much more in this book we won't have time to talk about. But I'm wondering, since you've done all this research, has it changed your perspective of this building? When you look at it now, do you appreciate it in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, it really makes me appreciate all the really difficult architectural conversations people had, the artistic discussion, how deliberate so much of it is, and also how accidental so much of it was. How much of it was the result of compromise? How much of it was the result of ego? How much of it was a result of hurt feelings and people just trying to get along and get something finished? And some of it is due to running out of money, which is one of those things that always tends to happen in, projects. So I think I really came to appreciate how it was and continues to be sort of this living monument. I mean, it's a building people still work in. People still, go into that building every single day. Don't always necessarily look twice at it. So a lot of people, it's just an office building. When I was a congressional staffer, we never really looked at it as just an office building. It was one of those things. I worked for a senator, and there were evenings where his admin would say, he lived on Capitol Hill, and she would say, "Senator's just going to walk home. He's over on the floor right now. They're debating. Somebody just needs to take him his briefcase and his coat so he can just leave the floor and just walk straight." Me, 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 me. We would fall all over ourselves to be the person that got to go over there, bring him his coat. You weren't even going to get to do anything, but just bring him his coat and his briefcase. But it was such a huge deal to even be in that building. There's a reason it's called floor privileges, to get on the floor of the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives. It's not something that you can, even as a Hill staffer, you can't just wander onto the floor. You have to be in the book so you can get it. So it's called floor privileges for a reason. It was really special, even just to do something as weird as just bring the senator his coat and his briefcase so he could walk home. Once you actually got to go down there and staff your member on legislation, there was nothing more exciting than that. You open the door coming out of the cloakroom, and it looks the way it looked in, 1865 still. I mean, the lights are better now and things like that, but it's still essentially the same setup. The desks are still in the same setup. And you walk in there, and it's very quiet. And you sit down behind your member, and you're trying to make yourself indispensable but invisible. You don't want to look at the cameras above, but it was always such. I never took for granted the fact that I was working inside that building. So I really hope when people read this, they will understand how important it is, but also how special it is, how it really reflects who we are, and how there's some deliberation in the symbolism in that building. Again, building it out of materials that will last. There's thought put into Where do the busts of the vice presidents go? What is in this room? What's the artwork on the wall in this room? There's a lot of thought going. Some of it's not. Sometimes it's ad-libbed. You know, again, that dome was an ad-lib, became an iconic part of the building. So there's a lot of who we are sort of just baked right into that building, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not. But I have never forgotten how special it was to be in that building. And I hope when people read it, it'll make them want to go back and visit it again and understand how special that building is.
To learn more, the book is The Capitol, The Surprising Biography of an American Building by Brian J. Jones. Brian, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you. Such a pleasure.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.